Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Tim Cortese. Today's episode of Oncology on the Go was created in collaboration with the American Society for Transplantation and Cellular Therapy, or ASTCT for short. ASTCT is an international professional membership association dedicated to improving the success of hematopoietic cell transplantation. During an X Spaces hosted on the Cancer Network X account, Dr. Rahul Banerjee, an assistant professor in the Clinical Research Division at the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Center in Seattle, Washington, and Dr. Shernan Holton, the chief of blood and marrow transplantation and a professor of medicine at Roswell Park Comprehensive Cancer Center, spoke about significant trials presented at the 2025 Tandem Meeting.
Perhaps what I can do, just to set the stage for those of you who are listening, I see a couple people here. While Shernan works to get her phone to work, the connectivity to work, is I'll talk about one of the late-breaking abstracts that I think I'm the most excited about, and that'll be LBA1, late-breaking abstract 1. In terms of, you have to choose one abstract that I think will be the most practice-changing for me, again, in the myeloma immune therapy space. LBA1 will be presented on Saturday by Dr. Garfall, Al Garfall and colleagues from a BMT-CTN study, but he's at the University of Pennsylvania, and it is a phase 2 study of IDA-cel followed by len maintenance as consolidation, basically, for patients with transplant who have a suboptimal response to therapy. The abstract is embargoed, so if you're looking at the actual, conference guide, you won't be able to see it yet. But I can tell you that I'm aware of like the broad levels of it, and so without spoiling any embargoes or stealing Dr. Garfall's thunder, I think what I can do is ideally will be a discussion with Dr. Holton when she's able to join. But in the interim, I think I can talk about what I think I'd be excited about and why this matters. I think it's a nice, way to start off the Twitter spaces, because I just said that, there's historically been historically it's been ASBMT, a little bit of CAR-T, and then more CAR-T, and then in 2023, where one of the late-breaking abstracts was actually the KarMMa-3 study, Dr. Sergio Giralt presented for the first time, CAR-T and myeloma outperforming standard of care therapy. So more and more CAR-T is coming, but it's still kind of been in two separate tracks. So I like this idea of merging them. In this particular study, this BMT-CTN 1902 study, cooperative group-led study, phase 2 single-arm study of IDA-cel, so also known as Abecma, CAR-T therapy in patients who have achieved an insufficient response, meaning not a CR, to induction therapy following transplant for myeloma. This is nice because it merges the two worlds, right? It's kind of like a tandem, but not really a tandem, because you're not doing two transplants back-to-back. You're doing a transplant followed by CAR-T therapy, first of all. It's not going to be not for everybody, right? Because we know for sure, and the reason tandem kind of faded away is that a lot of people don't want to do tandem. Patients don't want to do tandem transplant. That was a BMT-CTN 0702, an older study. But also, I think that a tandem transplant is over-treating some people and under-treating some people. And so here, kind of a risk-adapted approach. What they did was that patients got transplanted. They got lenalidomide maintenance, which is the standard of care for multiple. Actually, some got more. So they don't get any maintenance. So len-based. So some got len. Some would have gotten, perhaps Dara plus len or bortezomib plus lenalidomide, et cetera. And then those who didn't achieve a CR by then, so not a complete response, so still residual M spike or some PET avid disease or something along those lines, went on to receive IDA-cel. Again, I don't want to talk about the results because, again, they are embargoed, but I think it's worth noting that the big questions that I would have, that I did have, is one, when were these T cells collected? Or I should say, what are the repercussions of the T cells being collected where they were? So these T cells were collected after transplant. There have been other studies that have looked at a planned auto transplant to CAR-T consolidation approach in either direction. And there, the T cells are collected before transplant. The hard part, because we don't know the answer, but there have been some data suggesting that at least for some patients, functional high-risk multiple myeloma, meaning myeloma with early relapse after transplant, is driven by T cell dysfunction. Not so much disease biology, but T cell dysfunction. And here you are collecting these T cells after transplant. These patients have just got a transplant or on len maintenance. Some may have lymphopenia. Already, a lot of my patients do have a low absolute lymphocyte count after transplant. Will that interfere with the possibility of getting to CAR-T therapy? The other interesting question will be on the other side. Here, unlike some of the other studies that looked at this question, there is both a KarMMa-2 cohort as well as a CARTITUDE-2 cohort that have looked at IDA-cel and cilta-cel respectively for the same idea, patients who have not achieved the CR after transplant. as far as I recall, in those studies, you know, it wasn't required to go onto lenalidomide maintenance thereafter. So it was part of investigator discretion, or there was a safety lead-in that didn't have it, etc. Here, a priori, the goal of this study is to get everybody back onto len maintenance thereafter. That really allows CAR T to be more of a consolidation approach in the true sense of the word, and not somehow trying to replace len maintenance. There are some pros and cons to that, right? So, I mean, and I'd love to hear from all of you as you start listening in and hear from all of you, right? When you talk to patients, one of the biggest reasons that they prefer CAR T therapy is that it is a one-time infusion, right? It's one time. You still have to come in for IVIG, still have to come in for labs. At least in myeloma, it's not curative. I don't call it curative, but you're not on treatment anymore. And here, you're adding len maintenance back to the mix. However, it can still have its roles, right? We know that len maintenance has, in several studies, prolongs progression-free survival. You know, meta-analysis prolongs overall survival as well. And so I think it would be really interesting to see how many of those patients actually get on to len maintenance, right? Because on the flip side, CAR T therapy absolutely can cause low blood counts thereafter. Patients with an issue with cytopenias, what we now call ICAT, immune effector cell-associated hematotoxicity syndrome. And, you know, are they all able to get onto len maintenance thereafter when len can also cause cytopenias? I don't know. And that'll be one of the interesting questions for Dr. Garfal to kind of discuss. Then I think the biggest question will be, what were the characteristics of these patients, right? Because I think all of us know in our heart there is a big difference between the patient who really makes us nervous, they do transplant, and after transplant, there's still 10% plasma cells on their bone marrow, or there's still, you know, an FDG avid lesion somewhere. The M spike is still kind of 0.3, 0.4 higher than I would like it to be. That doesn't mean they're relapsing, but again, it makes the patient not feel great, doesn't make us feel great. So that's one scenario where I think, you know, CAR T is very interesting. The second scenario would be, of course, like the patient where the M spike went from 8.0 to 0.5 before transplant, that is now 0.1 after transplant. You have to wonder, well, is that really the patient where you're worried about, you know, needing to jump to CAR T therapy right thereafter? Dr. Garfal, I'm sure we'll talk about that or be asked about it in terms of, you know, how do you really tell that these patients had residual disease and it wasn't just the AM spike taking time to clear? The fact that here everyone, they didn't go straight from transplant to CAR T, right? There was a pause in between when they're on lenalidomide maintenance. It'll be interesting to see how many months worth of treatment they were on. Because some people, obviously, yes, the AM spike is 0.1 after transplant, but give it a couple of months and it's down to zero or undetectable. Again, if it does that, that's not the patient, I don't think, who needs CAR T therapy. But again, if it's someone where there's still truly residual disease that is probably melphalan refractory, that would give me pause. Any thoughts from people listening in about, you know, that particular trial or CAR T and transplant as friends? Again, I mainly treat myeloma, so some of you have insights. I've heard of it, obviously, but, you know, seen this concept from leukemia or from lymphoma, where, again, the two are friends and not foes. I would love to hear from you about how you would think about a trial like this in a new domain like myeloma, chasing a transplant with CAR T.
How are you? Long time no speak. It's Jan.
Hey, Jan.
So question for you. I guess looking at the landscape of immunotherapy, and specifically cell therapy, if we look at the domain of, let's say, like the lymphomas, if I'm not mistaken, at recently CAR T cells is like first relapse refractory. So, assuming that that multiple myeloma will go along in that direction. My question is, what would be the relevance of doing this particular trial if, let's say, in the next few years, first-line relapse refractory would be CAR T cells?
Great.
Would, great, you know, question. If we go along that domain and we, you know, would this trial still hold value? Or would you, from the perspective of, at that point, if I'm not mistaken, one would undergo CAR T cells, you would see if the patient would relapse. If the patient does relapse, I guess a more important question would be, would or could they still qualify for this trial that you're specifically speaking about, going then with transplant followed by CAR T cells again, seeing if you can have a long-term durable remission?
Great question. So you're asking, this is a question, and I would love to hear from others too, because this is a question really across the domain here. As you start moving CAR T into earlier and earlier lines, what is your control arm, you know, going to be for a randomized phase 3? This was a phase 2 single arm study. For example, this would not be enough for FDA approval. And it wasn't even designed that way, right? Because this was a cooperative group study, BMT-CTN, just, you know, doctors and nurses and APPs, you know, rolling up their sleeves and getting to work. This was not a pharma-run study. But a phase 3 is coming. And so you know, Karma 9 actually was going to look at this question, actually, and then they stopped. But maybe other studies will kind of pick this question up. And so probably I'm with you. I think a randomized study would be a CAR-T is consolidation for a particularly defined risk of patient populations. And that may be any number of things. Right now, again, failure to achieve a CR after transplant is kind of, as I mentioned, it's decent and it's a worldwide available, but it's not perfect. Another better corollary may be actually MRD positivity in the future. Someone's still MRD positive, do you chase them with CAR-T versus not? So the trial will probably be something like that. Like if MRD positive or failure to achieve at least X depth of response, CAR-T now versus CAR-T later at first relapse. I think the challenge, and I would love to hear from any of you who are in the leukemia space would be a good example, is that, you know, leukemia is probably the best example that when patients relapse, they just do so poorly that, you know, now is your best chance to do anything, which is why, for example, like, you know, Blina moving to allotransplant, just as an example, we kind of just do it rather than waiting for them to relapse, because when they relapse, it's often ugly, there's attrition, we're not able to get to the next line of treatment, etc. Myeloma, thankfully, is not that bad. Some of our patients absolutely have very aggressive relapses, but most of them, you're absolutely right. If you weren't to do a CAR-T consolidation and, you know, wait and wait until they have a relapse and move to CAR-T, then it'd be very interesting to see to compare the two approaches. The strength of waiting, obviously, is that some patients will not need CAR-T therapy ever and they'll do great. And
hey, Rahul.
Yes. You're here.
Can you hear me? Am I here?
Well, I would love, no, this is a perfect segue because actually Jan, Dr. Leifman asked a question about, like, basically in myeloma, we're talking about BMT-1902, Dr. Al Garfall is presenting it. Why chase a transplant with CAR-T when you can do CAR-T at first relapse? And that's actually a very elegant question that could be relevant to other domains, not just myeloma as well. I'm curious to hear how you would answer that question. Like,
my take on it, not from a disease perspective, but just from not from a specific disease perspective, but from a biology perspective. Mm-hmm. You know, the way I describe transplant and CAR-T similarly, I want more good guys than bad guys going into a fight. And so I think it makes a lot of biological sense to move forward with CAR-T pretty early when you have a fewer number of tumor cells, tumor burden. I think that's a recipe for success. You know, just playing a numbers game in terms of how many good cells do we have to target the bad ones. But that said, obviously there can be other challenges with that. There's certainly, you know, the risk of having unresolved toxicities from your auto transplant all the time off from work, all the medications, all the expense, you know. So from a, you know, biopsychosocial, you know, situation, I don't know if that's the right answer, but from, you know, like a tumor immunology perspective, I think I would want to go in quickly with CAR-T to try to give me the best chance of a long-term remission. That's my thought. I don't know. What do you think, Rahul?
I love that. No, I agree. I mean, I think honestly, one of the really, because I agree with you, and we talked about the risk of attrition as well, that independently mm-hmm. what the cells are doing, like often some patients have, you know, aggressive relapses, again, often more in leukemia than in myeloma, but to the point where you try to get them to CAR-T at first relapse, but as you know, it's hard, especially to collect the T cells and get everything logistically sorted out and so forth. Yeah. I think what will be really interesting is someday at this podium, because we were talking about earlier, by we, me, I was talking about how ASBMT become ASTCT has really evolved. I will say there are some bispecific stuff going on here at these tandem meetings as well. And so that will be interesting. So the MASTER-2 study, just as one example, for patients who are MRD positive after induction of myeloma, they're being mm-hmm. randomized to normal maintenance or to a bispecific plus lenalidomide, for example, as opposed to Darolen. Possibly a bispecific certainly has some time toxicity. You are spot on in terms of people don't want to go back to have to, you know, right back to being inpatient, dealing with the acute toxicities. But certainly a bispecific not nearly as bad as having to go right back to CAR-T therapy all over again. So that will be the other.
But it will be interesting. But do you exhaust your T cells? You know, do you potentially negate some benefit of CAR-T down the road if you're using up your T cell bank and all the energy that you have in your immune response.
Totally, totally agreed. And that'll be the other interesting thing to see if you go to Q4 or Q8 week dosing. Luckily, in myeloma world, we're all doing Q4, but it's you're totally, it's definitely weekly. I would be like, okay, these T cells are completely, and I should add to Shannon's point, is even if someone's MRD negative, if you keep giving them a bispecific, those T cells are still getting exhausted because they're still binding normal lymphocytes or plasma cells or whatever. My hope is that Q4, and it's actually fixed duration here, is like 2 years of fixed duration teclistamab, and these patients probably wouldn't relapse for 4 or 5 years later, so they're able to bounce back afterwards. But you're right, this is why we need the phase 3 studies, because we can speculate, and even for this phase 2 study of transplant with a CAR-T chaser, it's really, again, we're looking forward to Dr. Garofalo's presentation, but I'm sure he'll acknowledge too that we'll need a phase 3 to chase this afterwards in terms of actually seeing in a randomized manner what actually makes the most sense. Is it disease control, but you have the flip side, the risk of T-cell exhaustion. Totally true.
Definitely. And it may not be a one-size-fits-all approach, right? You know, people will have certain things going on in their lives where they can't go to a CAR-T. But, you know, alongside these big studies, I hope that there are blood samples being taken so that we can understand the immunobiology of what's happening and really probably, you know, have a better sense of how to understand what is more likely to be of benefit given someone's immune profile at a certain point in time. You know, do you foresee a future where we'll be able to actually tell what someone's immune response will be to a various therapy?
I would love that, right? They're working on it, but yeah, CAR T is going to be so hard to predict, right? It's not just about the target, it's also about the T cells and the milieu that they're in. I hope so. That would be wonderful. I don't know how you think it is, how close we are to that in any domain. I feel like we're probably still at least 5 years away.
I think so too. I mean, we have an ALC, you know, the absolute lymphocyte count, but is that everything? I wanted to take this moment to kind of transition to Abstract 50, but still stay in the CAR-T world.
Yes.
And this was a real world analysis of early CAR-T in relapsed refractory diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. This is a retrospective study from the Cell Therapy Consortium. So this was 150 patients with relapsed refractory DLBCL. Their procedures were 2018 to 2023. And basically what they were looking at is there a difference in survival when someone receives their CAR-T in second line versus third line or later? And I thought this was interesting that in a relatively small cohort, they found no difference in 9-month survival, whether someone got their CAR-T in second line versus third line from a numeric perspective. Or a statistical perspective, if you look at the curves, it looks like there is a potential benefit to second line, but there was not enough statistical power to determine a difference. But here they show basically in the multivariate analysis that a high LDH is bad for, you know, PFS and overall survival, same with performance status. So there's something about obviously the tumor burden or the proliferation rate and performance status that's going to give us some answers here. But I don't know what you thought about the second line versus third line or later.
Yes, this is excellent. I have not seen the actual Kaplan-Meier curve. I'll be looking for it very intently. Do you know if they adjusted? Now, I'm just curious now for time since diagnosis. Do you know if that was, I'm going to look at this MVA right now.
It's a great question. I don't recall. I do think they looked at the number of lines of therapy, irrespective of second versus third or later. And the more lines of therapy, the worse someone did.
Right.
So the theme seems to keep coming up in terms of cell therapy versus other therapies. And I don't know if BiTEs were included in this analysis per se, probably not, or probably very few, if any, but the theme seems to be use your cell therapy earlier in the disease course.
Agreed. Yeah, because then, you know, the one, you said better T cells, and two, patients love CAR T therapy and being off treatment and what it offers. Mm-hmm. But myeloma, but it goes across the board, so that's helpful. Yeah, I think the hard part will be, I think, yeah, like there's so many covariates, and I love these consortium-based data because I think they're the best way to answer these. I'm sure 80%, not 50% plus of the patients would not have been eligible for any of the Zuma or the Juliet or any of those, you know, transformed trials. So these are real, people joke about real world being like, you know, like a gimmick, but it's truly true, right? These are patients actually who've been treated. I do wonder where they're, you know, third line treat patients, maybe the fact that they got CAR T therapy, do they by definition have more indolent disease? Some of them do, right? Because clearly they did okay with their other lines of treatment and maybe went on to third. Or you could argue that they may have done worse because the patients who cycle through everything. And that's why I'd be curious to hear whether obviously right now at first relapse in lymphoma, CAR T is approved, you know, technically for relapse within 12 months. I think that's still the case. Within 12 months of transplant, where you're kind of adding that temporal factor where it's not just the fact that someone had a relapse, but it's a relapse earlier than expected, those are the patients where you're like, ooh, something is weird, bad is happening with disease biology, time to pull out the CAR-T gun. And that's what I would be interested in seeing, how they adjusted for that. But we'll see. Obviously, these kinds of data are interesting. I guess the question will be, and I don't know if you know this answer now, I mean, there have been studies looking at like frontline CAR-T. I think one of the Zuma in the 30s somewhere looked at it. Mm-hmm. When you say earlier is better, do you think it should be a part, let's say, of frontline induction with R-CHOP or Polar-CHIP or consolidation? Or you think kind of second line is where you would draw the line, like at first relapse move to CAR-T? Like how far would you push the yeah. CAR-T train forward?
I think it's a great question. And I think it is being addressed. Is it Zuma 23? I have to confess that this is not fully my space, but I do believe that that's being looked at in the frontline therapy right mm-hmm. now. I think it's going to come down to, so I think we both know, and the field accepts generally, that the long-term control of any malignancy has to involve the immune system in some way. And some people, after intensive chemotherapy for lymphoma, are able to recover, I think, some kind of anti-tumor immunity and have better immune function and have that long-term remission. If you're not able to achieve that on your own, maybe that's the person that needs some kind of consolidation with a CAR-T therapy. I'm speaking like a transplanter here, obviously, because I am. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that just chemotherapy itself can induce enough of an immune response in some patients with these diseases to contribute to long-term disease control. But then agreed, there are some people that just, that are not able to generate that response.
Agreed. Yeah, this is great. And again, I'm glad to see, I think this is an oral abstract. So again, I just making a plug for Real World Consortia. Many of you who are listening to this, maybe, you know, your faculty or maybe like patients, and you're wondering like, where is my data being used for? Like, this is the kind of thing it's being used for, where it's actually, again, patients being treated at smaller centers, patients who have, for whatever reason, wouldn't have qualified for the trials. As all of you may know, is devilishly difficult to qualify for clinical trials. I spend probably, you know, for every patient that I put on a clinical trial per month, probably there's three or four whom I wanted to, but the lymphocyte count wasn't in the range, or they had a skin cancer removed 2.9 years ago and it didn't count, that a slot went away with them to get to three. And so I love these data. I'm glad to see a lot of them being presented at Tandem, obviously.
Definitely, definitely. Kind of moving on to other spaces where CAR-T can be applied. I think we're seeing a lot more data about CAR-T in autoimmune disease. Interested to see where that goes. And then solid tumors as well. And there was, I'm just going to highlight my boss, because I think it would be a good thing to do.
Fair and fair.
Highlight a poster that we have from Roswell Park. And this is by a study led by Dr. Brian Betts, who is technically my boss, but also my co-conspirator, co-researcher, and just, you know, really good friend. And he's just a brilliant scientist. He has a really nice poster that I'm excited to see where the field will lead. And, you know, to those who have posters, not orals, you know what, there's a lot of gems in the posters. So don't feel bad about that at all.
Absolutely.
He identified a marker that is targetable by CAR-T for breast cancer. And this marker is CD83. CD83 is not widely expressed in normal tissues. The one place you do tend to see it is mature dendritic cells. And a few years ago, when we were both back still at the University of Minnesota, we discovered that CD83 was an activation marker expressed on T cells and B cells during acute and chronic graft versus host disease, respectively. And then we also found that CD83 was expressed on AML blasts. And that is like the holy grail for transplant, right? Where you can, you can have a target for both disease and graft versus host disease. And so we're looking at opening our clinical trial for CD83 targeted CAR-T for AML as soon as we can get the IND and have all of the regulatory pieces in place. Hopefully this spring we'll open that study. But he got the idea to look at breast cancer too. And lo and behold, highly expressed in breast cancer. So I'm really hopeful that the work that we do in heme malignancies can continue to translate outside of the classic, you know, heme malignancy space.
Absolutely so. Times a thousand. And obviously there's unique challenges that come with it, because you have to get the T cells actually into the, you know, ecosystem where there's a much more suppressive tumor microenvironment, but the potential is far, far greater, right? Like, as you said, the number of patients with breast cancer benefit from CAR T probably dwarfs 10 to 1. Exactly. The number of myeloma patients might benefit from this. And so super important. What I thought was interesting actually about this was, I think they mentioned that you have an ongoing pilot looking actually at adding, I think, IL-18 armoring, something along those lines.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you tell me a bit about that? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, definitely. So our CAR T for heme malignancy is like, we're lucky, relatively so, that heme malignancies are a bit more susceptible to CAR T therapy without doing anything super special, right? Besides what we're aware of in terms of co-stimulatory domains and so forth. But in solid tumor space, it's a whole lot of extracellular matrix and tumor-associated fibroblasts and all kinds of other, you know, physical and immunologic barriers to getting CAR T in there. And so you have to make the CAR T a little bit more aggressive. So we have clinical trials right now where we're armoring CAR T with different cytokines and other, you know, types of mechanisms to help keep those CAR T going, keep them alive, keep them fighting. And, you know, we'll have to see where that goes, but it's a very, very early area that we're exploring right now, but I think that's going to have to become the standard in solid tumors because it's just not going to be as easy as heme malignancies.
Completely agreed. And IL-18, you know, there aren't any approved drugs. People have tried recombinant IL-18. It doesn't work that well. But, you know, if you could do it right, you know, obviously it potentiates T cells, prevents exhaustions, keeps them going. And so this kind of stuff is fascinating.
Right? Like putting little packets of fuel. It's like stuffing my pockets with gummy bears before I go exercising or something. Like, you know, just a little bit of energy to keep you going when you get tired.
And it's funny how, yeah, like it comes down to the right. It, like I tell patients about these armored CAR T trials and they're like, oh, it sounds like you're like treating the T cells like humans. And I was like, oh, absolutely so. They're getting so exhausted trying to penetrate that. And whether it's IL-2 obviously has its own side effects. Like obviously with TILs, for example, with Lifalusil, like Amtagvi, people are using like, you know, high dose IL-2 as part of the package. And that's a lot. I feel like most patients, they hate the IL-2 more than they hate the actual time toxicity, the actual treatment itself, right? And so if there's a way to do it armored and have it kind of paracrine delivered just in real time and not given to the whole body where the patient's getting all the side effects and cytokine release syndrome that I'm sure these cytokines can release on their own, that would be awesome. So yeah, well, I'm excited to support.
Yeah, it sounds like science fiction, right? Like, but it's real. It's
completely,
real life.
Completely agreed. So that actually, you want to pivot to the next one?
Yeah, go for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting because there'll be a lot to talk about. And I'm sure in the Q&A, if we have time at the end, I would love to talk about some of the, you know, cilta-cel, you know, now I happen to be in the myeloma space and we happen to be watching CAR Ts do very rare, but very horrible things like the CAR integrates into TP53, T-cell lymphomas and this and that. So as we build the CARs of the future, I think adding this armoring will be part of it. And the other part will be adding safety switches or suicide switches, so they're called, to prevent issues from happening. So I think the next abstract is abstract number
891. Yeah, the cilta-cel colitis. So tell me, I had never heard of this. I've seen a bunch of cilta-cel, you know, treatments over the years, but I've never actually seen colitis, or maybe I just missed it.
You haven't missed it. It's all new. I'm the corresponding author for the paper that kind of brought it to life. It was a big, actually, speaking of consortia, this was a U.S. multiple myeloma immunotherapy consortium, just talking and being like, we had this weird case of diarrhea. We had this weird case of diarrhea. Doesn't really make sense. It's not just cilta-cel. Ida-cel, actually, ours was the case at Fred Hutch, who had Ida-cel related colitis as well.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Got it.
So basically, typically like 1 to 3 months after CAR T therapy, profuse watery diarrhea, sometimes evidence of colitis on radiographic imaging, rule out CMV either by biopsy or even peripheral blood CMV testing is typically no viremia or very low level if so. Rule out infection, it's not a bacterial cause of infection either, it's just profuse diarrhea. Like my patient was having diarrhea, easily loose stools for like a month. Some patients require TPN, some people have died of it. And I think what we published about this in Blood Cancer Journal last year, and again, this was like a Herculean effort from across many different sites. One, actually, at the Moffitt team was actually able to look and find CAR T cells in the act. They were polyclonal. So we'll come back to this point maybe in like the Q&A if anyone wants to ask about cilta-cel and T cell lymphomas. These were not T cell lymphomas, probably on a continuum of the continuity of some sort with them, but these were polyclonal T cells infiltrating into the gut, the lamina propria, and causing havoc. And I think what we have learned and what we've really put forward in that paper without much evidence, but at least from the best that we can tell, is that ironically, corticosteroids aren't the fix that we want them to be. All of us, like really? You said, we're transplanters at core. And so we kind of like, all right, like diarrhea, whatever, let's give some steroids, like treat it like gut GVHD. And basically these patients, it doesn't respond as well. Patients are end up being on steroids. My patient was on like 6 weeks worth of prednisone and obviously had like telogen effluvium. She like lost all her hair, super deconditioned, possible adrenal insufficiency, all this bad stuff happened. And I was at the time, I was like, what is happening? I've never seen this before. And we talked around, actually right around a year ago at this time at Tandem, we kind of talked about this and we were like, we should write this up. And so we actually found that some people actually had tried treating this, not like GVHD of the gut, like a transplant style, but treating it like a checkpoint inhibitor associated colitis, like the way that solid tumor docs might do with, for example, they would often use infliximab to shut off the cytokines or even vedolizumab, which is a, you know, ulcerative colitis drug. We sometimes use in GVHD, but not that commonly to kind of prevent the lymphocytes from getting in. And at least half-ish, small n for our case series, but in at least half of the cases the steroid refractory colitis, this seemed to do the trick. Why it happens and why didn't it happen in the trials of this, like it's never been reported with CARTITUDE 4 or KARMA 3 or anything, unclear. Probably something, again, about real-world patients, something being different about their disease biology. We think that knocking out the long-lived gut plasma cells in some patients, like normal plasma cells are being knocked out by the CAR T cells, and something about that in some small minority of patients, 1% to 3% of patients is causing problems. So if it happens, and I've had people email me and call me since and say, oh, I had a patient exactly like this. And again, my advice would be if any of you treat patients with CAR T, and this has been reported, there's one case report of this happening after CD19 CAR T, one case report. So, but it's rare, but any weird unexplained diarrhea for your patients, obviously one, think about infection, rule that out.
Right.
Think about a T-cell lymphoma, which is super rare, but again, I'm sure we'll talk about that because they're having cases and those often do manifest with diarrhea. And three, if it's not that, think about this IEC-associated enterocolitis and using, again, not just try, you can try corticosteroids, but early jump and use our citation as a shield for insurance companies to jump to something novel biologic like infliximab or vedolizumab, et cetera. And so what I would say there, I mean, I would love, obviously, everything I'm saying right now, I'm sure in 5 years we'll be like, oh my God, we were so dumb. It actually is blah, blah, blah. That's what's causing it. But we're still learning about this as we go. So,
well, it's still an early field. It's like the early days of transplant. You know, we're learning by experimentation. And, you know, there's probably no mouse model of this, right? Any mouse model where we're putting in a CAR T, you know, the mice are going to die of tumor or, you know, some other complication before this would happen. So these later effects, I mean, they're just going to take a bit longer to manifest. And we have to be really careful observers of our patients to pick up on this. So I think that's amazing that you're able to detect this and really describe this entity that only happens 1% to 3% of the time. That's incredible.
Agreed. And so I think what's interesting is the poster we was in a Tomorrow at Tandem. And again, I agree with you. The posters, I think, are some of the most interesting part of the discussion of both transplant and CAR T. And we should pivot, obviously, to BMT eventually. You tell me.
Eventually. Why. We'll get there.
But what I'll say very briefly, they looked at predictors of it. And ironically, similar to transplant, not exactly the same, but similar. The use of alkylating chemotherapy as a bridging regimen seemed to increase the risk, possibly by inducing some sort of gut damage that the plasma cells are trying to recover to, and the T cells get in there and it turns into a mess. Obviously, some patients still need alkylating chemotherapy as part of bridging for myeloma. But now with these modern bridging approaches, you know, we have an ASH oral last year about from the consortium about using talquetamab. So using a bispecific targeting a different antigen as bridging before BCMA CAR T, maybe that would avoid this. So I would say that'll be a poster worth checking out tomorrow.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. So thank you for that context. That is amazing, and I'll certainly keep my eyes open. Now, abstract 572, tell me about driving restrictions post-CAR T.
Okay. Now, I promise you, if you want to pivot, I know we have 20 minutes left. I am fine pivoting coming back to it.
totally okay. Let's just hit it real quickly.
Okay,
it's all good.
You're kind. That is my poster. So okay, it was her idea, not mine, if anyone's listening. So we are also on behalf of the Myeloma Consortium. In brief, and this is relevant to all CAR-T programs, the FDA packages or an EMA regulatory guidance recommends 8 weeks of driving restrictions after CAR-T, which some of you actually may not realize. Like I actually, when I went through fellowship, I didn't even realize that was even being discussed. It was kind of being mentioned in passing, but some patients take that advice very seriously. It's because in the early days of Axicel, right, of Yescarta, there were some cases of delayed neurotoxicity, maybe a delayed seizure or two. The 8 week number is kind of arbitrary, though, I would argue. And you can imagine, we were talking about time toxicity earlier, that patients who have put their life aside and their caregivers put their life aside for 4 weeks just to get through CAR-T and the REMS requirements, et cetera, are now being told you're free to go, but you can't drive for 4 weeks, which means you can't get your own groceries, which means you can't go to doctor's appointments by yourself, et cetera. And basically, we argue, you come check out our poster tomorrow for those of you who are here, but that is not evidence-based. And we, our goal is, and it's actually true for everything, although we just happen to look at myeloma. So our goal is actually going to be to take this to the FDA. Obviously, the regulatory landscape is wildly changing day by day in the US right now, but our goal is still going to be, the FDA has relaxed the REMS requirements for all CAR-T for an education training. The last year, they did some tweaks here and there. So the FDA is capable of changing their guidance, and this may be an example to do it. That's all I'll say.
Yeah. Perfect. And I can't think of anything more patient friendly because, gosh, it's such a barrier just to get to us. And so few patients actually cross that finish line of getting their CAR-T or getting their transplant. And the more barriers we put in the way, you know, the less likely we're going to get patients to these really important therapies. And that's a big one, right? So if it's not based in any kind of good medical guidance, then, great. We need to actually take a look at this and hopefully propose some changes. So I can't think of anything that's more patient friendly. Now, even though we are, we're coming up on 45 minutes here, I do still want to hit this abstract by Dr. Herr, Megan Herr, physical functioning. And again, conflict of interest. This is my coworker. Again,
she's great. I met her this morning in the poster line. So yeah, go ahead.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. So Dr. Herr is amazing. She's an epidemiologist at our center and has really an incredible series of abstracts and soon to be papers looking at physical functioning and outcomes prior to CAR-T and transplant. And why this is special is, we're incredibly fortunate to have really amazing dedicated physical therapists on our team who do detailed physical function assessments prior to CAR-T and transplant. So everybody gets all kinds of testing that I think a lot of centers don't necessarily routinely do, including balance, Romberg, the use of hand grip to understand frailty, things like that. So this is just routine. And she looked at our data for patients undergoing CAR-T for non-Hodgkin lymphoma between 2018 and 2023. This was 91 patients, diffuse large B-cell background. And she found that if you were not able to balance on your left foot, that increased your risk of ICANS by basically 2.5-fold.
Wow. I was not expecting that. Okay, that's...
Simple test. Can you balance on your left foot for 10 seconds, right? And if you cannot... That increased your risk of ICANS by 2.5-fold. Why is this? We can speculate. We don't know for sure, but it has something to do with your neurophysiologic reserve potentially. And then if you use assistive devices for walking, if you have a strength deficit, if you have a positive Romberg, any of those, they predicted mortality. So basically, she was able to put these physical findings together into a model where she combined that with hematotox scoring. And if you had a high hematotox score and two or more of these physical findings, survival at 1 year was only 9%. So this really highlights, even within a high hematotox, those patients were at extraordinarily high risk of not really benefiting from the CAR-T. So, important work for sure. And it's, these tests are so simple to do. I think it's going to be interesting to see if others can reproduce this.
Agreed. Fascinating. I will look for the poster. I'm very excited. I mean, we need that. I use that. And it's one of those actually, it's not like some panel of novel cytokines that no one in the universe can do. Anyone can do that kind of a test. And that's the test that we need. Yeah.
And I guarantee you that like all of the listeners on this space right now just stood up to see if they could balance on one foot.
I know. It's not post-call. I'll say that much.
Yeah. I know, exactly. Well, transitioning to transplant, we had a few transplant abstracts that we wanted to talk about. One I think is a really important abstract. This is looking at allotransplant for MDS, which I think everyone can recall that this was not something that was even approved by Medicare up until mm-hmm. recently. It was all done in the context of a clinical trial. So this is looking at allotransplant for MDS in Latin America. This is a registry study. The transplants occurred between the 1980s and 2023, 441 patients looking at survival outcomes for allotransplant for MDS by age. And they showed that if you're over the age of 65, survival was not statistically different than those who were younger. And so, you know, really still saying allotransplant is beneficial even in the over age 65 population. However, being over age 65 was associated with relapse. Your risk of relapse was almost threefold higher. And then your risk of relapse was about fourfold higher if you received reduced intensity transplant. And then 5-year survival was around 50%, but most of the deaths were in the first year. So important registry study highlighting, yes, you should still consider allotransplant even in older individuals for MDS. But obviously we have a lot of work to do, especially in terms of relapse.
Absolutely so. I'm curious now looking at this, actually, it's also a LATAM registry, right? So the first author was from Brazil, looks like Argentinian authors. Great to see them on the stage because, again, this is like important stuff even for U.S. physicians as well. Is there anything different? I actually don't know this answer. I don't know if you know. If it would modulate that risk if her MDS, how it's treated in the U.S. versus in other countries, especially in terms of lower middle income countries? Probably not. You know, venetoclax wouldn't be used either way for this scenario. So it would probably just Vidaza. Yeah. It would probably be azacitidine.
Exactly. Probably not. I don't think, you know, and if there's anyone online who can correct me, I don't think that the primary treatment would be that different. You know, a decent amount of time, there is no treatment prior to transplant. You know, if you meet high-risk criteria by IPSS or all the variations thereof, you know, proceed straight to transplant. And then if there was therapy given, probably a hypomethylating agent, but there's not a lot of treatment options. And it just shows also we need better conditioning. My personal hope for this space is that our field can come up with more novel conditioning regimens such that we can ablate the marrow without causing those GI toxicities or other organ toxicities and do that so effectively that we don't even need maintenance therapies for a lot of conditions. So this is my wish for the future plug early. I would like us to have better conditioning regimens for allo because we've basically been doing the same thing for, you know, decades at this point.
Great. And then I think there's another registry is the one right after this, right? It's the CIBMPR this time.
Yeah, so this is Joseph Padala, only 18,000 patients. So I love these studies.
What they do best, indeed.
Exactly. Like let's take a look at an enormous population and read the tea leaves, but I think it's really cool. So Joseph Padala and co-authors from the GVHD Working Committee of the CIBMTR wanted to take a look at risk factors and kind of patterns of immune suppression discontinuation in the modern era. And this was a multi-state model from patients who were transplanted between 2009 and 2019. And this is relevant. When I was a fellow, or even earlier, you know, just getting interested in transplant, you know, I'm looking at the papers by Stephanie Lee and others, and these are all in the, you know, late 90s, very early 2000s. Showing the male to the female transplant to male recipients, for example, this being a risk factor, so on and so forth. You know, do these things apply in the modern era?
Sure, sure.
And yeah, so I thought it was a good chance to kind of review. He showed that out of this cohort of 18,000 plus people, that there was a rate of discontinuation of immunosuppression in only 37.1% of patients. So obviously, you know, we've got more work to do there.
Absolutely so.
And I think if we, you know, when we do the next paper 10 years from now, it's going to look a lot different because of PTCy. There was some PTCy in the paper or the abstract that I'll talk about, but obviously, you know, we're in a different era now. The median time to discontinuing immunosuppression was 6.8 months. I thought this was interesting. It was 5 months median to discontinuation of immunosuppression if you had no GVHD.
Mm-hmm.
Rahul, at our center, we stop immunosuppression at day 60 if there's no GVHD.
It makes sense. You're not gaining any ground at that point. You're probably losing theoretically some GVL. Like, you're not. What are you protecting against? Agreed.
Right. So why, if you have no GVHD, are you on immunosuppression for 5 months? So I'm fascinated by that. I was certainly, you know, raised in a program where you tapered starting at day 100, but like, wow, that's just a long haul. If you had prior acute GVHD, you were on immunosuppression a median of only 1 month more at 6 months. But if you had chronic GVHD, it was basically 21 months on immunosuppression. And that's even a little less than what I was used to, you know, growing up learning about chronic GVHD.
Sure. Agreed.
The median was about 3 years on immunosuppression. So in the more modern era, we're saving some months on immunosuppression, but still 21 months on all these drugs, it's a long haul.
And my guess, hopefully you're right, things will get better. I mean, PTCy is not going to fix everything, but it will probably fix a lot of this. And I think you're people just used to tapering steroids earlier. Hopefully that number, the 5 months, will start to come down, because I agree with it. It's not doing patients much benefit at all. And we've kind of talked about time toxicity many times here. That entire period of time that they're on steroids, even afterwards, there's some, obviously, you know, infection precautions, but especially when they're on it, like these patients are not, they're living their life, but they're not really living their life. And 3 versus 5 months is a very big difference, I would argue, in terms of patients with no prior GVHD.
For sure. So I'm going to make a provocative prediction for the next paper. I predict that steroids won't be the first line therapy for acute or chronic GVHD.
That is extremely provocative. Replacing it with Rux or with something different? Or
who
just
knows?
Fair.
Right? Like, I think maybe it'll depend on the organ. Certainly, JAK1, JAK2 inhibitors are excellent for graft versus host disease. You know, both acute and chronic setting, but you know, maybe we'll have a little bit more specificity. The thing I don't like about broad immunosuppression, obviously, is the potential for infections, the potential for relapse. Agreed. And so when will we be coming up with organ-specific immunosuppression? You know, you were just mentioning TNF inhibitors for immune effector cell-associated colitis. Unfortunately, we know that didn't pan out in graft versus host disease. But that doesn't mean that we should stop looking for alternatives and being more specific. So I'm interested in these CD6 targeting agents, anti-CD162. You know, we're trying to pick out the pathogenic T cells, not all T cells. So can we have more specificity? Veto for GI, GVHD, for example, right? Do we really have to give someone systemic immunosuppression that is harmful to all of the immune cells that we still want to preserve to have infectious immunity and to fight the cancer for which we did the transplant? So that's my hope for the next time this paper is written.
I'm looking forward to it, and hopefully you will be hopefully soon, but it'll take some time. Agreed. Great.
It will.
And then pivot to the last one then. I think this is actually interesting. I think you found this one, right, Fernanda? This is fascinating. Can you maybe tell us a bit about it? I see Roswell.
I
see you.
I'm
okay. But this actually sounds fascinating. It's about social media, GVHD, the patient voice. I'm all in. Can you tell us more?
This was a really cool opportunity. So working with Meredith Cowden from the Cowden Foundation and several others to do a type of study that I've never been a part of before. This was a fascinating experiment. So this abstract, this poster, and please go check it out. This is abstract
57.
Oh, 57. Thank you.
Sorry, 516. I just can't count. Sorry. 516.
I can't. Okay. 516. Yeah. Yep. Please check it out. So we performed what we called a social media listening study for chronic graft versus host disease. And so we worked with a company to basically download all publicly available social media that mentioned GVHD in some form. So this, again, had to be public posting. We did not go into, you know, patient advocacy groups and Facebook and stuff like that. That's all private. But public posting on X, TikTok, Instagram, Reddit, YouTube. And basically collected all those posts, filtered them to make sure that we were getting the patient or caregiver's voice. So if this was an advertisement or support group or something like that, those were removed. And these had to be firsthand accounts only. So what we're able to do is, after all of that filtering, we came up with about 7,000 some unique posts. And we're used kind of a language model to pick out themes from these posts. So just interesting, right? What are people saying about their experience with chronic GVHD in public? And there are some themes that came up, and I think everyone would expect this. One was a cycle of physical, mental, and emotional impacts, right? Obviously, there's a lot of physical effects of graft versus host disease, but this leads to a lot of distress and a lot of exhaustion and a lot of loss for patients. So that was a big theme. And then another theme that honestly broke my heart, and you know, we need to do more about this. The theme was invisibility, that patients and caregivers felt that they didn't that the public didn't understand about graft versus host disease, and that made them feel invisible and misunderstood. So, ouch, you know, that is painful to hear. And so obviously in the medical field, I think that we need to do a better job of explaining what our patients are going through and being their protectors, especially in the setting of, you know, pandemics, right? The all of the public health measures that were important to protect people, they protect the most, you know, the people who are least able to mount that immune response. We need to be thoughtful and protective of them, but they feel invisible and misunderstood. So I don't know, Rahul, does that kind of resonate? Does that sound right to you?
Times a thousand. Yeah. I mean, it's the power of social media, as evil as social media can be. Sometimes it's the one case where it is helpful, but you know, we're not part of the conversation. Yeah, I mean, like both you and I are on Twitter right now, or whatever it's called now, X. But you know, we're not all, like, honestly. Exactly. I mean, for myeloma is a good example. Like both of my patients are on Facebook, and I have not touched my Facebook account in like 5 years, right? And so there's a gap there that we need to figure out how to bridge. May not just be us, but someone.
Yeah, absolutely. A couple other themes that came out. About 10% of the posts were about difficulty accessing treatments and costs of care. And that's important. You know, you look at some of these newer GVHD treatments, and I'm so glad that we have them. But if you don't have good insurance, or if you, you know, can't get grants and so forth, I mean, some of these, like, imagine a pill that's $600 a single dose. You know, that's reality. And how do our patients access this? So 10% of the posts are about those struggles. And then another 10% of the posts were about the positive piece of having a good relationship with their primary, or I'm sorry, their healthcare provider, be that their primary transplant doc or nurse practitioner, someone from the care team. About 10% of the posts were about gratitude. What do you think of that?
We need to make it higher or figure out what those people are doing. Like, despite all, like, the, as you said, like, feeling invisible, feeling that there's, like, loss of agency of a lot of their day-to-day life, whether it be with side effects of GVHD itself or the pill financial toxicity, that's what they're remembering, that, like, these people are here to help me, the transplant team. And so,
yeah, exactly. So I thought that was incredibly nice, but also kind of painful. Like, wow, like, we don't deserve you. You know, we caused this disease in transplant, and we need to do everything that we can to take care of you. And here you are going through such difficult times, and we're you know, obviously trying our best. But, you know, we recognize that we have, in some of these cases of severe graft versus host disease, we've traded one disease for another. And, you know, we're all not happy about that, right? We recognize this is a cost of transplant and a cost of a life-saving cancer therapy. But, you know, goodness gracious, it's awesome to see that we're finally making some progress. We have new treatments available. There's hopefully more recognition, and we can still work together to try to make life as good as we possibly can and to improve physical function, to take away some of this mental distress, and then work together for advocacy too, to help with peer support, to help with resources, to help relieve some of that misunderstanding in the community. So, you know, I thought this was a really unique opportunity. I was really glad to be a part of this and would like to see our field do more of this. Rahul, we get caught into kind of spheres of influence, right? Or like thought bubbles. And it's helpful to hear from the outside what the appearances are, don't you think?
Times a thousand. Completely agreed. When it's not even, they know the doctors aren't listening and doctors aren't listening, but just how they're actually experiencing it. And even PROs, as you know, don't necessarily capture that because they're so structured. That's their that's their pro for us, obviously, but that's obviously the con, right? You're not actually, unless you do qualitative research of this type, like you're not capturing the depth of like what, for example, in my like grade one dysgeusia or any of that, or grade one mucositis, like what that actually means for the patient or the GVHD setting. What does chronic GVHD actually mean for them in terms of eye issues, joint issues, et cetera? I just don't think like a 1 through 5 scale captures that nuance.
Think about how many times you heard in abstracts the therapy was well tolerated.
Right. I exactly right. I mean, I've seen people look at this interesting, and this, we're running out of time, obviously, like, what is it called? Like twist tox or something where you can actually try to capture the toxicity over time. That's the other part of it, right? That like the maximum grade of a toxicity tells you nothing necessarily about what the patient's actually going through while having it. And so how long have they had it for? How expensive is the treatment for it, et cetera? And so,
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Well, we are right on the hour here. I guess any closing or any other thoughts that you're excited for outside of Tamiflu for 2025 in the space of CAR-T or DMT or both?
I mean, both, honestly. You know, from the transplant side, what I'm looking forward to seeing is more studies looking at novel conditioning regimens and then looking at reducing toxicities. I think we have really effective GVHD prophylaxis right now, but, you know, it certainly comes with its own toxicities. How can we further reduce toxicities and, you know, maintain those excellent outcomes? So I'm looking forward to that. And then really looking forward to seeing CAR-T expanded beyond heme malignancies. So I can't wait to see some more of the solid tumor and autoimmune abstracts. How about you?
I love that. Yeah, and what we alluded to earlier, which would be topic for a whole other Twitter spaces someday, would be how do we make CAR-T safer, right? We've come such a long way, like you're saying, but now these rare Parkinsonism cases are still happening. But now that we've heard of the actual thing that we dreaded all along, that the risk of a CAR integrating into a gene where it shouldn't insert is, again, this is an MSK published these data last week in New Journal of Medicine. We need to figure out how to make that better with CAR-T in the future. So not just new armoring with IL-18, but also new safety switches. But the field is headed that direction. I think it lost some steam, but it's going to come back, I think.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or you can listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the Journal of Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at @cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancernetwork.